Members, thanks for the invitation to join the discussion. I'm very pleased to be here. I think this is a really pivotal time for social care. And I thank the members here for their continuing and enduring interest and attention to this area. I haven't given you a fresh paper today because the paper that we originally submitted back in February to inquiry is still valid. I went back to it in June thinking, wow, I wonder if any of this will be relevant after COVID. And then I thought, well, it's not just still relevant, it's kind of hyper relevant. So I'll pull out the key parts of that, particular emphasis on the bits about commissioning and procurement, because I think they are of interest to the committee. And then I'll talk about how things could be different. But first of all, I really want to say something about what social care in the third sector is and what it does and why it matters. Our paper goes into this a little bit. In the third sector, social care isn't really a service like other public services. You know, we don't cure you, we don't deliver your babies, we don't put your fires out, we don't bring you to justice, we don't get you an education. We don't generally wear uniforms, and you won't see us in TV dramas on Saturday nights. What we do is we get alongside you when you have very significant challenges in your life and when you struggle to participate in society as full citizens. And we support you wherever possible to make your own decisions and move your life forward as best you can. And where the world makes it very difficult for you to do that because of your age or your impairment or whatever, then we do what we can to help by ensuring that you're comfortable, you're cared for, you can have at least some kind of independence, peace of mind in your individual circumstances. Now, if you look at what third sector care and support organisations say they're all about, you don't find that there's much there about services. You find this kind of stuff. Okay, so a couple of examples. Our vision is for the people we work with to lead meaningful and independent lives in a world that supports them to achieve their own ambitions. Give you another one. Our mission is to enable everyone to live a valued life, the life they choose. Another example, this is your way to a brighter future. And the shortest one that I could find from amongst our membership is simply, we support good lives. So that's hard to capture and it's hard to summarise, at least partly because what these organisations do in practice to support people will vary according to individual need and preference, and it's not seen as particularly exciting or sexy or critical, certainly not to TV producers on a Saturday night. However, when people have to live without it, it leads to huge stress and distress. And when it becomes the focus of attention, as it has during the pandemic, then everybody finds out just how important it is. So over time, that basic proposition, which is a supportive relationship for people with challenges in their lives, has been overlaid by a very, very substantial architecture of legislation. And in modern times, the foundations are probably the 1968 Social Work Scotland Act, 1970 Chronically Sick and Disabled Persons Act. I think I'm getting a bit anarchy here already. And both of those, they conferred really important rights on people with care and support needs and duties on public bodies to meet them. Then you had the 1990 NHS and Community Care Act. That's the one that introduced the market for social care, and I'll come on to that. And then, obviously, since 1999, the Scottish Parliament has introduced a significant range of additional legislation that refined and revised and modified all of that. So what we've also done over time is to codify that basic proposition of a supportive relationship into a set of categories: home care, housing support, care at home, day services, respite, so on and so forth, and a set of tasks, generally to serve budgetary and monitoring requirements. Now, I'm long enough in the tooth, probably like Eddie, to have been in front of this committee or the predecessor committee when we took a lot of time to identify what we thought personal care might be and how it differs from any other kind of care, simply because we had put ourselves in the position of considering making some of it free, but not all of it free, and therefore we had to codify what was free and what wasn't. So over time, again, this codification has infiltrated our system to the extent where an awful lot of the supportive relationship, again, which is the basic proposition, is now pre-specified into those categories and those tasks, often precisely timed tasks, you know, right down to 15 minutes in some cases, and they're put into detailed contractual arrangements, again, primarily for budgetary and monitoring purposes. And the risk there is that rather than what people actually want and need, is now described as social care. And I think this is echoing some of what Eddie said. You know, we can help someone use the toilet, but we can't run an errand for them. We can help them get dressed, but we can't clean out the fridge, even if the errand or the fridge is what's really, really important to someone. And this is what people mean when they say that social care has become service-led rather than person-centred, which is what we all want to do. So I would encourage the committee to see care and support not as a service. It's a vehicle through which people who face all sorts of challenges in their lives and live their lives alongside those of us who are fortunate enough not to face those challenges. And it is absolutely, Eddie's right, it's a rights-based issue. Now, this is not an original thought in any way. The independent living movement has put this far better than me, and I think committee members have probably already been referred to Inclusion Scotland's statement of ambition for social care support. And if you haven't, I would heartily recommend it. So the paper we submitted back in February sets out what we think the kind of key ingredients are for making a success of all of this. Okay, so there's the right policy framework, the right workforce, really good critical challenge. And in our paper, we were clear that there wasn't enough of that. A diverse range of providers, appropriate use of digital technology, and so on and so on. I'm happy to go into any and all of that, but I won't repeat it all again today. What I do want to say is something about commissioning and procurement, because those are the mechanisms by which our sector, third sector, becomes engaged in all of this. And I think it's worth separating out the two. So strategic commissioning is the exercise through which the needs of a population are identified, the desired outcomes for that population are agreed, and decisions made about what kind of care and support then needs to be put in place to meet them. And that should be a very collaborative affair by its nature. Procurement, on the other hand, is not collaborative. It is competitive. And it involves, as I've said, the codification of meeting assessed needs into detailed category and task-based specifications, which are then appended to contracts, put out to tender, using public procurement processes that are fundamentally no different to any other kind of public purchasing mechanism. And that is why we find ourselves looking at documents in which groups of disabled people are described as lots, and why charities like our members have to bid against each other in order to be awarded a contract to support the people grouped into those lots. And that contract, more often than not, and this is a really critical part, is not underwritten by a financial arrangement that covers the cost of delivering it properly. And when up to 80% of a non-residential service is workforce cost, you can see what's going to happen when we compete on price. So if you ask me, you clearly are, that's why I'm here, you can trace an enormous number of the critical failures in our social care system, especially those that have been identified in the last 6 months, right back to that. That's the root cause right there. So one really good example of this that I think has already been across the committee's radar is the what we discovered during the pandemic with a lot of care workers, especially in the private sector, only receive statutory sick pay if they have to self-isolate, which is why a fair few of them kept turning up to work when perhaps they should not have done. But the National Care Home Contract, which is drawn up by COSLA and Scotland Excel on behalf of local authorities, doesn't allow for any more. And an awful lot of care at home contracts drawn up by individual councils don't allow for any more either. So this isn't really about bad employers, although they do undoubtedly exist, I wouldn't deny that, but it's much more complex than that. And the position taken by both central and local government is that fair work is a matter for social care employers to sort out. So tendering processes have to be sharpened up even further in order to root out the bad employers, is more or less what the guidance says. But an awful lot of contract values are simply not sufficient to support much more than statutory minimums. Plenty of providers get hauled in by commissioning officers and told to shave more off their price. So in any other kind of market, buyers, which is what a lot of us have become now, we take our business elsewhere. But in publicly funded social care, the public sector is the only purchaser in town. You know, it's the opposite of a monopoly where there's just one provider. It's called a monopsony, and that's where we are. Very few charities support self-funders. That's not the business we're in. So we only have one purchaser. So the proposition, you're a hard-pressed public authority, the proposition of being able to control costs because your suppliers have nowhere else to go initially very attractive. You let the market do what it does. Your providers compete with each other. They bring your price down for you. But eventually you run out of road because a price-driven market in a monopsony under severe financial pressure will start to see the quality providers exiting the market. And that's what we began to see pre-COVID. So how could things be different? Well, we've been working with our members on some alternatives to a competitive market in social care. We're calling them our big ideas. Fundamental to these are the actualization of self-directed support. We never like competitive tendering much, to be honest, but the introduction of self-directed support is kind of what really tips us over the edge in that respect, because we could not possibly see how people could be supported to exercise choice and control on their own behalf when all the choices about the support made, available for them had already been made through procurement processes. It's like you can't keep these two thoughts in your head at the same time. And also fundamental to our thinking is sustainability and the appropriate use of resources. So we came up with four tests or any alternative to competitive tendering into the market environment that we have that we might propose. So the four tests would be, number one, does it shift the power? Number two, does it increase choice and control for individuals? Number three, does it improve accountability and transparency? And number four, does it improve the sustainability of social care? And having set those tests, kind of off we went. Now, we're still working on these. At an appropriate moment, very soon, I hope, we will share them with the committee. For now, I can say that they include things like alliancing. So alliancing is a particular type of contracting arrangement where commissioners and providers collaborate with each other as equal partners in pursuit of a common endeavor, sharing risk and agreeing rather than competing about who does what and with what rewards. They include suggestions such as agreeing at a suite of rates, different kinds of support everybody signs up to. And then if we have to have a competition locally, then let's have it on quality and not on price. And by a sustainable rate, I mean a rate that will cover and continue to cover the cost of a properly rewarded and supported workforce following fair work principles. They include a suggestion that we might want to look at going back to grants instead of contracts, again, to stabilize our organizations and our workforce, and critically to link the amount of grant and its conditionality to the meeting of individual need and outcomes as required by self-directed support. So our big ideas are just that, they're ideas. But if I may respectfully say so, the National Care Service is just an idea. They're all half-formed things that haven't yet been tried and needed a lot more fleshing out to see how they would work in practice. But I think we know enough about what doesn't work to be able to give at least half a mind to what might. And that, I would say, is the territory that we now need to enter. So we're up for that. I hope you're up for that. I think I'll just kind of stop there and leave more time for discussion.